Well, hello, good evening, and welcome to this live stream event on the 25th of May, 2021. Whoops, I'm a year behind myself, 2021. Martin North here from Digital Finance Analytics. We're having a bit of fun in the pre-show second, just trying to get everything sorted out. So we made it. Phew! Great to see everybody on. Very important conversation tonight with Damien, so we'll get going in a second. Just as I always do, remind you of just a few important points. We don't offer financial advice on this channel. We don't know your individual circumstances, so this is general conversation only. Do please play nice in the chat room. We do moderate the stream. No racial slurs, please. This is as at the 25th of May, 2021. I got the date right. That's good. So if you're watching in replay, you'll know whether we got it right or wrong. Use at What the World to get my attention if you want to get your question asked and answered. And I've also enabled Super Chat, which does two things. It enables you to get your question to top of the list and also potentially make a contribution to help with the running of the show. We don't do this for profit. We do this because we think it's really important. And there's a lot of very significant questions that people, I think, need help with. So that's why we do what we do. So any contribution to support us is greatly appreciated. And there was a very nice little comment there, which I'm just going to put up, which I think is actually quite funny insofar we don't want another 2020. No, I tend to agree. That wasn't the greatest year in history, was it? So we'll stay in 2021. Okay, well, with that, let me bring Damien in and make sure that things are working. Hi there.
Hi, Martin.
Eureka, it's working.
Yes. Let's not jinx it. It's working so far.
Fingers crossed. Yeah, it's quite funny, really. And thanks very much for spending some time with us tonight. Look, there's a really interesting conversation. And what I want to do is to tell you about the question that I got, which prompted me to think about this show. Right? A guy called Paul wrote to me 4 or 5 days ago and said, look, I'm finding this really confusing, right? Because there's so much volatility, you know, cryptos are way down, the main market indices are off, people are talking about significant corrections, you know, he cited people like Harry Dent and some other people out there in social media land. So he said, you know, is it sensible to even ask about whether in fact you can invest, you know, sensibly, rationally, and relatively safely? Or is it a time just to sort of sit on the sidelines and think, well, things will get better later? Now, of course, you guys have to be in the market, so you have to invest. So I thought it'd be really good to have an exploration of some of those dynamics, right, and how you think about it. And then we'll take the conversation a little bit further after that. So that's what I wanted to explore tonight, you know. Is it conceivable to invest even in these times?
Yeah, sure. And I guess, and I'll preface by saying, look, it is your comment you made about having to be in the market's very important for who you're hearing from. So, you know, especially if you're talking to somebody who's just equities only and they're telling you to buy equities, then obviously, you know, as these people can be very very honest and they mean well, but in the end, if that's the only thing they can buy, you know, so the thing about, you know, the person with a to the man with a hammer, every problem starts looking like a nail. So let me tell you where we're coming from, I guess, is just so that people have that in perspective, is we end up buying 4 different asset classes for our clients within superannuation and within investments. People can come to us directly to invest in just equities if they want, but most of the people who come to us and will either invest in Australian equities, international equities, Australian government bonds, or cash. So very much these core high quality assets that we're trying to we think sort of sit in the middle of somebody's portfolio. So the idea is, I guess I wanted to say that because it means that when you talk about cryptocurrencies, I'm going to tell you no, I don't think you should be buying cryptocurrencies. I think it's more of a speculation rather than an investment. You know, it actually worries me how much it keeps popping up when people talk about investing in cryptocurrency. I'm like, no, you're speculating. Don't confuse the two. But So I've obviously got biases, but I think the biases are at least the fact that you know that, you know, I switch into bonds, I switch into cash, I switch into equities. You know, we can go back and forth between the two. It does mean that, you know, I'll talk about those assets, but it does mean that I don't feel as if I have to be in equities every step of the day, every second of the day to make money from it. Having said that, over the long term, that's where you're going to make the most amount of money, is from investing in equities over the longer term.
And of course, there is a track record over a long, long time of equities over time performing, right?
Yeah, that's right.
And of course, one of the interesting observations is we had a really significant crash back in March last year, right? And it dropped significantly, right? And I know that there were a number of people who got so scared then they basically bailed close to the bottom. And in fact, I did an interview on one of the local radio stations last year when prices were really rock bottom, and they were asking me, well, should you get out? And I said, well, over the cycle, right, they come back. Yes. And actually, if you do sell at the wrong time, particularly when things have actually slid significantly, you probably are bailing out precisely the wrong point in the cycle. But it takes a lot of effort sometimes not to sort of sell at the point where everybody else is selling, right? Which is the psychology of the markets.
Yeah, and I guess there's a lot of other factors that come into it. But I'll step into those in a minute, because before we jumped into it, I also wanted to just hit up really on this idea of, you've used the word certainty in your in sort of pitching this show. Mm-hmm. And I guess I just wanted to also give, in terms of background for people, just give them an idea of where the way I think about this as well, is that, there's obviously very little that's certain in life. and there's the other thing that the bigger importance, though, in terms of investing, is there's a big difference between what we call risk and what we call uncertainty. So they sound like they're the same thing, but it's a nuance that's important. So if I roll a dice and, it comes up as a number three, but you're not surprised, and you think what's coming, and you think that, okay, I've got a 1 in 6 chance of everything that comes up, but and that's what you'd call, that's a risk, in terms of saying, if I have a 6-sided dice and it's equally weighted, then I've got a 1 in 6 chance of each one of those coming up. I know what the outcomes can be. The difference with uncertainty is, I said I had a dice, I didn't say it was 6-sided. And all you can see is the numbers that have come up over the past, and try and guess whether, what numbers are there. And then the next thing I know, and is it equally weighted? Is it a fair dice? Or is it predisposed to comes up with, say, 1s and 6s more than it comes up with 3s and 4s? And that's where we are in investing, is that we don't know the set. We don't know what we're playing with. We don't know what the rules of the game are. We're trying to infer the rules of the game from what's happened in the past. And you don't know whether things could be different. And an example I often use for anyone who does a bit of gambling and knows roulette, it's a bit about saying, there's a roulette's a table, a little ball spinning into buckets, and you've got 36 numbers it could fall into, and a zero is a 37th. And if you were playing that game and you're making money, and all of a sudden the ball happened to be perfectly balanced between two numbers, and the house took everyone's money from you, you'd be like, just a minute. Not only did I not know that was possible, I didn't know what that was the rule as well, that the house would all of a sudden take everyone's money regardless. And it's those types of uncertainty parts that in terms of investing is that, people talk about them as being known knowns and unknown unknowns. And so they're the parts we spend a lot of time trying to work out what's the next thing coming down the pipeline. And so where we attracted a lot of money in terms of our fund was we were very early onto the coronavirus and following that as a trend, because we thought markets were a bit overvalued, and we were looking for what is the catalyst that's actually going to drive it. And that's why, at the time we were like, okay, we've got to clear out of equities, got to clear out of these things. And we sort of sat around for a month just wondering whether we were crazy. Like, the markets were just zooming on, and we were like, just a minute, have we lost it? Is this, are we not seeing it? And then before it finally hits, and that's the part where, you just don't know how market's going to react. Mm. And so now we're in this situation where the two big things I always look for is how much debt is around. And I guess probably debt's even the wrong word. How much leverage is around is probably a better term, because there are other ways you can get exposure to markets sort of going up. And then the second part is the valuations of the market. Because if there's not a lot of debt around, then there's a bit more safety in terms of it being, okay, well, if this hasn't all been built up by people taking margin loans or people taking big bets on options and all these other ways of drawing down on their home loans and people having huge mortgages. If that's not a problem, then you're less concerned about markets crashing, because what tends to crash markets is forced sellers. So markets can sort of fall back a bit, but then if people are then have to start liquidating their assets to pay off margin loans, or they've taken particularly asymmetrical bets, which I'll talk a little bit about later on, then that's where markets can be quite vulnerable to big falls. And the issue is right now there is a lot of debt around. It's not as much as we've sort of hit it at certain extremes. The margin debt can still go a bit higher relative to where it's been in the past. But on the flip side, there is a lot of there's a lot of option trading, and that's sort of another thing that sort of doubles up on it. And there's a lot of big institutional investors who have invested in something called risk parity, and that is basically it's some pretty fancy words around and pretty fancy maths around the risks and things that you're doing. But effectively, what it means is you take an equities portfolio and look at how much risk is in an equities portfolio, and then you take a bond portfolio and say, well, that's got a lot less risk because the assets in it are a lot more stable. And so what that means is actually you can borrow money against that bond portfolio to leverage up the return. And they use a lot more fancy words to make it sound a lot sexier than that when you put it together. But the net effect for me, when you look at it, is you used to have an equity and a bond portfolio. Now you have an equity and a bond portfolio, and you have debt. And the fact that you've sort of bucketed that debt against the bond portfolio doesn't change the fact that you're still looking at a portfolio that's got equity plus debt, equity plus bonds plus debt. So, so markets are vulnerable from that perspective. So, okay, so that's the bad news. So I've got a bit of bad news to come to, but actually let's a few questions on that before we get the debt side.
Yeah. So just in terms of, we're in unusual times. Let me just in a post I made yesterday, I talked about Robert Shiller's comments on CNBC the other day, when he said, look, we've actually got the Wild West, really, where things are actually, compared with fundamentals, a long way from where you might think they would be, for the reasons you've just articulated, right? Government intervention and all the debt. And there was an interesting article today in the AFR in Ken Clear, which basically picked up a conversation from somebody who was around, who was actually advisor to Bernanke, and was very much the architect of quantitative easing in the early days. And in fact, I made another post, if somebody wants to go and look at that in more detail later, not now, later, I went through that in more detail. But his point was, again, the thing you've got to take account of is that this is governments messing with the markets, right? This is governments throwing huge amounts of money into the markets and taking, frankly, a lot of bets on where the markets are going and how they're operating. So we really don't have a standard set of markets in which we're operating, and therefore the standard rules of engagement and the standard way of thinking are actually questionable. And I thought that was really interesting, that more people are saying there are some weird things going on, and it's all to do with the quantitative easing and the amount of debt and all those things, which makes it then hard to try and actually determine how much of this is noise and how much of it is real.
Yeah, and I think you're almost getting to my good news part there. So that, I'm sort of saving some of that stuff for later on, in terms of, that's some of the positives behind this, is or in terms of positives in terms of making me want to be more invested than sort of saying, sticking my money under the bed and hoping for the, hoping it all blows over or you get a crash at some stage. Because there's so much intervention, is that the biggest thing we're worried about at the moment is really policy error from central banks or governments. But let me get to that later, because I think that's probably jumping two or three chapters ahead in the story, as to what the story I want to tell you in terms of risk versus uncertainty. So we've got this first problem, which is debt. In terms of this, there's three other places you can have debt, or three main places you can have debt, is consumers, corporates, and business. Now, corporates in the US are chock-a-block full of debt. Elsewhere in the world, they've got a lot of debt. It's not at sort of record highs like it is in the US, but there's a lot around. So corporate debt's high, which is a risk. Having said that, you know, the Fed showed that it stepped in to actually buy corporate debt, or actually didn't. It said it was going to buy corporate debt. I don't even know whether it actually ended up having to buy any because the spreads all came back in. So we know that the central banks will actually help support that corporate market. So there's a lot of debt within that. Within consumers, Australia's chock-a-block full of consumer debt. The rest of the world isn't as bad. They've certainly come off their highs that they hit in the housing crisis of 2008. And so most of the rest of the world could add a fair bit more debt and still not be back to where they reached in 2008. So there's one side there. And then lastly, you have governments. And governments have got pretty much more debt than they've ever had before. Australian governments is actually the exception there in terms of we don't have that much debt at all, really, relative to the rest of the world. But so there's sort of the debt. Can it go higher? Yeah, sure. Consumers around the world, not as much in Australia, but certainly elsewhere, could add on a lot more debt. We think governments could add on, you know, a fair bit more debt, especially with lower interest rates. Corporates are pretty limited in terms of how much corporates could do. Some countries they can, but yeah, corporates, sort of that's one area I'm not really expecting to see a lot more debt added. Yes, so that's the debt side. The other thing I was saying that you've got to be worried about is valuation side. And that's the stuff we had Sheila talking about. So there's lots of different ways to look at valuation. And Robert Shiller's got a very famous one, which is the Shiller PE. Yes. I like the Shiller PE as a concept. Basically what it does is it takes the last 10 years worth of earnings and then adjusts them for inflation, because it says, well, if you weren't, you know, 10 years ago, whatever you're earning, we should at least adjust that up for the price of inflation to get that at a realistic price, and then compare that to the current share price of the market or of the individual stock you're looking at, and that throws out a Shiller PE. The problem with the Shiller PE is, I think it was, I haven't got the numbers right in front of me, but it's ballpark this, is that if you took the average over the last 120 odd years that he's sort of published data for, and then said, okay, I'm only going to buy the market when it's below average, you would have bought the market in the late 80s, and you would have had one more chance in the middle of the GFC to buy the market, and that's it. The rest of the time, you would have been sitting on outside equities, basically for some of the greatest bull runs we've ever seen. And so you do need to keep in mind that there's no one measure that really stacks up to this. And I guess my issue with what the Shiller PE doesn't capture as well is changes in composition and changes in margins. And I think for me, what I've seen over the last 20, 30 years is that, number one, the companies aren't the same companies. So if you're even within the companies that are the same, they're very different. So if you look at Boeing, 30 years ago, as a big aircraft manufacturer, they used to make a lot of the parts themselves. They're effectively a manufacturer, and they had all these operations around, and that's what they did. And as time went on, they became more and more of an outsourcer, and running the sort of the intellectual property of how a plane should fit together, and outsourcing a lot of the parts to everyone else. And what that meant was, in terms of the margins that the company actually earned, is that it went from earning 1 or 2% margins to earning 6 or 7% margins. So much, much higher margins, because basically anything that was low value, they would outsource that to somebody else. And so what that meant was, from an earnings perspective, the earnings was very good, but the other part was that you've now got more of a service company than a manufacturer than what you used to have. And just the profile of that company is just different in terms of the earnings it gets. The other thing is, if you look at profit growth over the last 30, 40 years, you can put down about a third of the profit growth comes because tax rates have been cut. So 30, 40 years ago, we had a 50% company tax rate. Now the average company tax rate is in the low 20s, I think. And, you know, the number of companies we're talking about, Biden's out there talking about getting global tax rates. a global minimum tax rates and whether for companies and whether we can get it to either 10 or 15%. And so, and we saw, you know, Trump cut company taxes. So, look, there's potential companies taxes might go up under Biden, but still, you know, the trend has certainly been down, and that's sort of captured a lot more that hasn't been captured in that Shiller PE. Is that there's, you know, part of this extra growth you've been getting, and reason why people are paying more for companies is because there's extra, you're getting extra earnings growth from either more manufacture, more service companies and less manufacturers, more tax cuts, and various things like the internet, you know, driving productivity. So there's been some quite good productivity gains, and the whole disinflation where inflation sort of has fallen from very high levels to very low levels, and interest rates have fallen as well. So I guess what I'm trying to get to is you do need to look at more than just one measure, and you do need to look a lot at forward factors and consider what's happening in terms of compositional changes. And so the net effect of that is, look, absolutely need to have valuation measures. Yes, markets are expensive at the moment, but I wouldn't just pick one measure, and particularly not the Shiller PE, and say that's going to be my one measure I'm going to use to decide whether I'm in or out of the market. And so, okay. So the
interesting point there is that, you know, there are various ways that people try and discern what's going on, right? And, you know, the chartists have their particular methods to try and actually identify where markets are going to move and what have you. And different people use different metrics. And I think there are, you know, features and benefits of most of those. But the truth is you need quite a complex set of data points to try and actually triangulate where we are and where things are heading, right? There isn't a simple silver bullet view. Right?
Absolutely. And the other thing I'd say is that, you know, you once you've gathered that set and you've got your view and you've said, this is what I think is going to happen, is don't look for people who agree with you because, you know, this whole thing about confirmation bias is one of human beings, you know, greatest weaknesses, in terms of you have this view that, yeah, look, I've decided I'm going to be in the market, and now all I'm looking for is people who agree with me, and I read those stories and it makes me feel good about myself, and it makes me think, wow, that guy's smart because he agrees with exactly what I say, and therefore therefore we're all right together. You should be looking at the people who disagree with you and the people who have the opposite view, and trying to really get through the logic and break down what exactly they're saying, and where are the issues, and how imminent is this problem. Because that's often the problem, is that, you know, I can tell everyone right now there's going to be a cycle. You know, market's going to go up, and then they're going to go down, and they're going to go up again, and then they're going to come back down again. But, you know, it's a meaningless forecast to say that there's going to be a cycle. It's knowing about, you know, the imminence and what the issues are and how big of a cycle it's going to be. And what we, you know, we sort of talk about these long-term debt cycles. I think we've actually spoke about this on your show, one of those, you know, a few months ago, when we ran through, you know, that the world goes through these sort of 50-year debt cycles of gearing up and then de-gearing. Then within each of those cycles, there's like another little line that's sort of the medium-term debt cycles that sort of bounces up and down. And this was around when we were launching with you, Martin, and we were saying at the time, you know, that you needed equities exposure because as much as we had thought originally that, you know, this looked like this global pandemic looked like a good reason for it to be the end of the debt cycle, is that central banks and governments stepped in, and we more importantly, we got vaccines that I think were unexpected in terms of it being, mRNA being a brand new source and having such great efficiencies, and we hadn't had a vaccine for coronavirus before, and now we've got like six or eight of them that are all working and ticked off on. You know, I think there's that whole what we thought might have been the start of the end of the long-term debt cycle has been pushed into another debt cycle, and it's going to be pushed higher again. So the question about, well, when does this one finish, and what's the momentum that's going to cause the end of this debt cycle? And that's the part where, while we can see what's going on, and you can see that you might be able to say, yes, look, the market's vulnerable, but on the other side, we've had great earnings growth, we've got governments pumping money into the economies, and corporates really taking it, generally speaking, when governments are out there freely spending as fast as they can, corporate profitability increases. Mm. And the issue you have, if you went completely to cash, you know, even in the last 6 months, so you'd say, okay, that's it, markets are too expensive, I'm just going to go completely to cash and wait for it to crash, is that if governments can keep the market sort of where they are or grind higher, you know, you could get sort of 5% per annum while you see, you know, 15% earnings growth for 2 or 3 years, then all of a sudden markets aren't expensive. And it's a question now of saying, you know, are there some big productivity gains coming down the pipeline from things like robotics, in Australia in particular, from energy prices sort of peaking? We've seen a lot of energy increases, and as solar prices come down and battery prices come down, that's sort of starting to put a lid on prices. You know, there's potentially driverless cars, there's this mRNA technology that is used for the Pfizer vaccine and the Moderna vaccine, looks like it's going to have a whole bunch of other uses throughout other things. There's a bunch of productivity measures which genuinely look like they're going to be positive for the world economy for the next 10 years. And so if you don't have a disaster at the moment and you have enough time for that earnings growth to sort of push markets and push company earnings back up again, and with lots of unemployment around, there's no real wage pressures on, so that just means that company margins just keep growing, then you can sort of paint this picture of saying, yes, markets should have fallen first, and then it would have given me a chance to buy, and then they would have rose, you know, as all these earnings came through, but it didn't happen. They sort of ground higher for a while, and then the earnings did come through, and then it was justified, and you just never got a chance to buy in as an investor. And I guess that's where we're saying that, I've got to get the guy's name who was right, but he expressed himself as being a fully invested bear. And I love this return of phrase, complete mental blank now of who said it. But it's a phrase where I'm not quite fully invested. You know, we're a little bit underinvested at the moment, sort of we look for market pullbacks and things like that, and just naturally a bit conservative. But it is that idea about saying, you know, there's markets over the long term do go up. And if you took the view always that no, there's always something to worry about. And right now there are a lot of things to worry about, but most of the things that we're looking at are longer term issues to worry about, not shorter term issues to worry about. Mm. Or not medium term issues. So yeah.
And your point about the fact that markets have continued to step higher and higher and higher, and you know, sometimes you think, well, it can't possibly go higher, and then blow me, it does. It goes right back to what we said about, well, governments continue to support the markets, and you know, the Fed is sort of in the middle of reverse repos to make sure that part of the market doesn't fall over. So wherever there's a problem, the cavalry come in and pushes the market slightly higher, right? Higher.
Yeah, and so I think we spoke about some of the risks before last show, but you know, the real risks to me is policy error. So governments starting to pull back, whether it's central banks or governments pulling back too early on the stimulus. And we spoke about inflation. I've actually got a piece coming out over the next few days, which I'll post up on your site, and I'm sure we'll talk about it. We'll come back once it's up and running to talk about the whole inflation issues. I mean, I think I spoke most of the last time on this, but it's around those same ideas. But it's the idea that if a lot of the inflation at the moment is an inventory cycle. So basically inventories are very short, and that's people are bidding up prices trying to get their hands on things, is that usually what happens at the end of the inventory cycle is actually prices fall back again. And so, that could be the next shock, I suppose, for the markets, is that, hey, not only is inflation not as high as what we thought it was, but it's actually starting to fall again. And so, anyway, we'll talk more about that later.
Very good. So why don't we just take a breath on that, and I just want to sort of pick up a few of the comments in the chat and throw a couple of questions at you, and then we'll come back and develop the arguments a bit more, okay? I just wanted to pick up this one from Donna, because she actually asked it right up front, and I think it's worth just coming back to it. So I've got a question for tonight. My payslip saw my boss puts in money into my CBUS Super, 10%. Showed me how to see my account my boss has put the money in. So there's an issue there about statutory I assume that's statutory superannuation, right? Companies and firms have an obligation to make superannuation payments, don't they?
Yeah, and it's pretty hard not to now, actually. Like it used to be a few years ago, well, not even that long ago, I'd say, when I say a few years ago, like 3 or 4 years ago, it was possible for especially smaller employers to do, I think, maybe once a year, and then they wasn't that well policed and things like that. Nowadays, everything's electronic. I think the last maybe, I feel like the last 18 months has been electronic, and it's very hard for employers not to. So I'm pretty sure there's lines you can call on superannuation to get to have somebody check up on that for you. So
there is. I can't recall off the top of my head who it is, but that there are organisations that are there to make sure that people are doing what they should be doing. If you are in an organisation and you're a member of a union, talk to your union because they'll be able to help you. And if you're not in a unionised context, even talking to people like even somebody at ASIC, if you contact ASIC, they can point you in the right direction in terms of, or if you look on the Smart Money website at ASIC, there's a whole section in there about superannuation and what the obligations are of employers. And I know that on that site there are some numbers listed there, so that's another place to go. But
and the big thing I'd say is do it early. Because the problem, and as I said, it's nowhere near the problem it used to be 5 years ago, because they are doing everything electronically now. But it was, employers, when they're falling short of money, can decide to not pay superannuation. Might be something that can be missed, and so I think there's it's usually a bad sign, a very bad sign, that companies are not paying superannuation. And so by waiting another 3 or 6 months might just mean you end up missing out on a much larger sum than if you get in early and raise the issue.
And the final point is CBuzz, you can always call them because that's where the superannuation is. And again, they should be able to give you some advice directly. So there's a few, but Damien's dead right. Don't just forget about it, be active about it, because they have a statutory obligation to make those payments. Now, let me just move on to this one, and this is interesting. This is from Bondi Steve, who said, if you're trying to invest on your own in these markets, you've got rocks in your head, pay for it. Now, Damien, of course, you'd say, this is tough, right? These are tough markets, right? It's not necessarily the market for the newbies to try and do it themselves.
Yeah, look, there's two parts to it. I guess one part is there's certainly a lot of people out there who are very bright at and working in quite technical fields that figure that because they're quite bright at, say, as engineering or medicine or whatever it is, then they can switch and be able to do quite well in investments. And there's certainly some truth in that. But the other thing is as well, there's a hell of a lot of money in financial markets, and they hire a lot of very bright people, and they spend a lot of time trying to work out how to take as much money from somebody else in the market. For every winner, there's a loser, and so maybe that's a bad way to put it. For everyone who outperforms the market, there's somebody who underperforms the market, and so if you're thinking that, hey, I have a few spare hours on a Saturday, I'll spend 2 or 3 hours digging through and look up a few stocks and I'll be able to beat everyone else, then it's going to be tough. You have to, and it's probably, you're probably going to rely more on luck than the work that other people, the other work, there's certainly people spending, billions of dollars on coming up with trading strategies to try and take money, usually away from retail investors. Retail investors are usually the ones who lose, and retail investors underperform, institutional investors outperform a bit. But the next problem is there's a lot of institutional investors who outperform but then charge more in fees than what they outperform by. And so the amount you're paying in fees is the next most important thing. Used to be very common to see places charging what they call 2 and 20, which is 2% plus 20% of any outperformance. And I would. There's very few firms that actually make money for their clients at that level. They make excellent money for themselves at that level, but making money for the clients is well, perhaps it's a secondary consideration anyway when it first started. So, you know, I think for the investment side, depends upon what assets you're talking about, but you know, somewhere between I think most super funds sort of around about 0.6 to 1%. And then if you're ending up on your super paying, you know, 1.5 or 2, then I think you want to have a serious look at who's doing it for you and whether that's you're in the right product. On investment side, again, it depends on what you're investing in, but most places sort of that 1 to 1.5% would be sort of the average. The more stable the assets and bigger the assets, then you'd be paying a lot less than that. And so, and for bonds, you'd be paying sort of 0.5%. Yeah. I guess that's. I don't know if that is that answering the question.
Yeah, no. I think it probably is actually. And in fact, Cookie Boy made the point, and he actually sent me some material, which I'll show in a second. That given the fact that super returns are so strong, why would you buy property, right? And he actually shared the APRA statistics, which I think this is probably the key one, right? Financial performance, right? So over the last 5-year average, it's more than 7%. But they basically said that in the quarter over March, total assets increased by 3.2%, right? So, and you know, in some ways, you could actually say that over the year, it's been a very strong year. Now, okay, you dropped back last March, so you're starting from a low base, right? But nevertheless, the returns there are reasonably, you know, positive, I guess, compared with term deposits. It's also worth saying, though, that those returns, as reported by the funds, don't necessarily reflect the returns of individual investors, right?
No, actually, and what's what's a dirty secret of the industry is that if you've been watching the fees over the last few years, what you've been seeing is administration fees have been going up. But investment fees have been coming down, and the big super funds will say to you, "Well, yeah, that's because they're starting to insource a lot of the investment. So rather than giving their investment to other people, they've been starting to hire teams in house to do it, and they're trying to give more services to members, and so therefore the administration fees are going up." And that's one way to put it. The other way to put it is all these surveys measure the returns after investment fees, but before administration fees. So if I had very high administration fees and very low investment fees, I would look a lot better on all these surveys. And so lo and behold, people's admin fees are going up and their investment fees are going down. And so, you know, it's just coincidence that they end up looking better on all these surveys.
Well, except of course that's the way that it's been determined by the regulators, right? To try and make an apples to apples comparison. It's just that they do hide quite a lot of costs. And yeah. Sometimes and, I say, go on.
And then the problem is people's costs vary by the balance. Yep. That's the big problem with it is most places have some sort of fixed fee. And so people who've got $50,000 are paying a lot more as a percentage of somebody who's got $500,000 in the account. And so, that's unfortunately that's the nature of the financial the way the superannuation is run. And, you know, sort of interesting, I don't want to kick the superannuation too much, but and we are a superannuation provider. So, I'll speak up. We actually deal through separate people for administration. So there's like an administration fee that goes to them and an investment fee that comes to us. But, So unfortunately we can't play the same games everyone else plays in terms of lowering one fee to make it performance look better. But, It's interesting that at the moment we've got our regulators trying to make funds merge to improve the economies of scale, and so they're out there basically very much limiting the number of new superannuation licenses and trying to make firms merge with each other to get bigger to bring the costs down, and it's sort of that it's sort of an interesting I guess take on the whole competition thing. Like most places would go, okay, we want lower fees. That means we need more competition. That means we need to open it up to new entrants, get more entrants, new entrants in, so they can actually force prices down and help improve it. Whereas we're actually doing the opposite. We're saying don't let any more new entrants in and make everyone merge with each other. And that'll fix the problem. So, yes, anyway.
Well, it might fix one problem, but it'll create another one. And interestingly, of course, they are encouraging some of those big US investment firms to come into Australia, right? And particularly those online providers.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's sort of a similar market to what we're playing in. And, I find it, we're unfortunately, we've grown very quickly. And so we have the assets sort of, in the hundreds of millions, but we don't have it in the most of these guys talk about tens or hundreds of billions of dollars of assets, and our costs are effectively about the same as the average fund. And I just find it quite incredible that some of these funds have so much, the amount of money they have under management, and they can't manage to get their fees down in terms of, and when you look at comparisons of what the Australian superannuation industry costs relative to other countries around the world, you find that it's very expensive in terms of the cost of the thing. Dr. Cameron Murray does a lot of great posts on this. I don't know if you've had him on your show, but his he talks about when you add up the cost of the tax credits that you give to people for investing in their superannuation, and then you add on the cost of the financial services industry to actually produce superannuation for people to do it, the cost is actually way higher than what you'd have if you just wanted to run a pension system for people to say forget about superannuation, we'll just pay everyone a pension. And so
UBI, here we come, right? Yeah. Now, this is one from Chris Paul. Why do you think that you can make most money in equities? What about the leverage that Metropolitan Sydney Melbourne Housing can afford you? Houses, not high density units, right? So this is the old property versus other things.
Yeah.
Liquidity.
Absolutely. Yeah, liquidity. Well, leverage is a big benefit for houses. Is that if you're looking at assets that go up over time, is that and you're certain that you're certain that the assets are going to go up, then finding an asset that where you can get whatever it is, you can put a dollar down and get $19 worth of actual exposure or $20 worth of exposure will work every time. The thing is, leverage cuts the other way as well. So in times when you get downturns, in Australians, in living memory, or certainly in recent living memory, it hasn't been a problem for the Australian housing market. But certainly for other markets, it does happen, and people who carry too much debt at those points really suffer. The big issue, I guess, is over longer term. For my part, all the stats I've seen, equities does way better in terms of the growth you get out of it, in terms of the income growth over that time frame. And I guess we're always generally trying to look at a return above inflation. I have a bit of a problem. There's a study out from the AMP that most people use to talk about long-term returns for property. And it talks about long-term returns from property basically being just a little bit lower than the returns for equities for like 100 years. That's not consistent with what I've seen from elsewhere. I believe what they've done from the limited sort of access I have to it is they basically haven't accounted for the CapEx side. They basically said, yes, the median house price back in whatever 1900 was this, and the median house price in 2020 is now this, and therefore you got a compound return of 11% per annum or whatever that time frame. And it's like going, well, yeah, but the median house in 1900 was some miner's cottage in one or two bedroom miner's cottage somewhere, and suddenly it's a four bedroom mansion 120 years later, and it was all magic. Not only did there was no reflection of that capital expenditure that went into it, and I believe that's how they got to the numbers.
I agree, there's no hedonic adjustment, right? So
yes,
that's the problem.
Capital expenditure.
Yeah, correct. Exactly. Yeah. No, that's exactly right. And in fact, if you were to make adjustments for that, the returns would come way down.
Yeah. So I guess what I'd look at is saying that the longer term ones, there's a study that comes out. I think it's Credit Suisse now that does it. It was originally a book called The Triumph of the Optimists, and they redo the study every year, which is looking about 120 odd years of returns, and they look at it across, 20, 30 different countries at least. And so you can sort of see, you know, where was it just that, was this just a matter of one country doing really well, or what about countries that, say, lost a war, like Germany or Japan? What happened to equity markets in those markets? And so it looks across, you know, quite a wide range. And the net effect is cash gets you the lowest return. Bonds get you a slightly higher return. They don't do the property side, but the stuff I've seen then says property sits next on the tier, and then finally you have shares at the top. In terms of the performance, and it's basically coming back to the amount of risk you're taking, but it also comes back to, I guess, valuations as well. Is that shares tend to be valued, they tend to be cheaper in terms of the returns you expect, because of the amount of risk that you get within it, and then properties sort of one step down in terms of you get lower returns because there is lower risk. Having said that, then if you go and put leverage to it, you can then get the same amount of risk, you know, by adding more leverage to your property, which is, I guess, the an Australian favourite.
Certainly is. And I will just give a quick plug for your property calculator on the Nucleus Wealth site, because it's quite a sophisticated calculator that you've got there, and you can put in a lot of different parameters and look at what the real returns of property are over time. One of the observations is that many people, when they make their calculations relating to property, forget a lot of costs. Conveniently, right?
Yeah, absolutely. That's what everyone reports as well.
Yeah. And it also does depend on the interest rate, doesn't it?
Yeah, but even, you know, even with hedonic, like hedonic does adjustments, don't really like that. Like they sound like they're doing a lot of good stuff, and then they are. Like in terms of they're trying to get around it. But the net effect is, if I went out and bought a 3-bedroom house, knocked down a whole bunch of it, put on the extensions, and you know, did all this other stuff, and it was still a 3-bedroom house at the end of it, the hedonic one doesn't know how much money I've spent. So I might have bought it for $600,000, spent $300,000 on renovations, sold it for $900,000, so broken even on the raw costs, and lost money on after interest and after stamp duties and all that type of stuff. And a lot of places will talk about that as a 50% gain. Yeah, I bought it for $600,000, sold it for $900,000. And you're like, that's not what happened.
Correct.
But that's what goes into the property price indexes.
Yeah, no, I agree. And like I say, when I look at my net returns on investment properties, which is trying to get all the costs, all the money in, all the money out, there are a lot of people underwater, as I think I've reported previously. Now, here's one from Greg. Greg, what's your expectations on the Fed? And will they put more money in? Will they do more fiscal if we get a repeat crash like previously? And the answer is, of course.
Absolutely. Well, and I'm not sure they'll wait for their repeat size crash. Like, I think you might get it before the repeat size crash is, I guess, where I'm coming from is there's issues around inflation at the moment. That's probably the biggest risk I see is policy error in terms of, we've had central banks telling people for a while, this inflation is going to be transitory. And it's just going to be around the short-term things. That is exactly what's happened so far. But the drumbeat of look out for inflation, it's here. It's about to be hyperinflation. It's Weimar Germany. It's all those types of comments. I think are if the Fed actually reacts to that, then we might have policy error and we could actually see some problems. But ex that happening, I think that's
So, and it's interesting, the notes from the last FOMC meeting, right, actually said they did actually talk about tapering and when they might start to tapering, despite the fact that Powell came out earlier and said we didn't even talk about tapering, right?
Tapering.
So it shows you that there is actually some diversity of opinion, to put it politely, within the FOMC, right, as to where precisely we are and how transitory this inflation is and whether we should be turning the dial back now or not. But it's interesting that quite a few of the senior Fed people are still absolutely towing that same line. This is just transitory stuff. It's basically the base effect. It's supply chain issues. It's not structural. And what we don't want to do is hit the brake too soon, right? Now, of course, what they've now done is redefined when they apply the brake, right? Because previously it would have been well, ahead of things happening. Now they're saying, well, we're going to actually have the accident first and then we'll actually hit the brakes. So.
Well, yeah, you know, part of the other problem is, though, like, you know, at least they've learned from the Japan issue where, you know, there's this whole, there's a saying out there about not letting the genie out of the bottle. Is inflation, if you let the inflation genie out of the bottle, you can't get it back in again, is what the saying is. And so, and I think that's, I think we've shown pretty conclusively over the last 20 years, we can get inflation genie back in the bottle. And you can convince people you've got some, you know, there's that, our problem over the last 10 years and 20 years in Japan has been, how do we get inflation up again? Like, we're fighting deflation.
We want the genie out the bottle, right? We want it out. Come on, coax it out. They've had terrible trouble in coaxing it out. And, of course, in Japan, which they've been at it the longest, it's going nowhere.
Yeah. And in the early days, Japan would go, we think we've got it. You know, inflation's back to 2.1% and up they'd go. And then next thing you know, they're printing deflationary numbers again. And then they're like, oh, we shouldn't have done that. Okay, let's try again. We can spend another whole episode talking about this, but I think the, I guess what I'm saying is the question was more about that Fed put. Is it saying, look, there is, I think the Fed is on the very much on the case now, and if markets started to tumble, they would then, and if they're making a policy error, they would then turn it around. And I think that's exactly what we saw, I want to say two Christmases ago. Might have been three, where basically the Fed was tightening, the market didn't think it should be tightening.
Yep.
The market tumbled until and Jay Powell had only recently come in, and he the chairman of the Fed, and he'd said, "Oh, it's not the Fed's job to bail out markets," and the markets kept falling until he did.
Yeah, exactly. So, the markets won, and that's one of my points, which I keep making to people. Right? People think that the Fed is somehow, you know, the leader of the pack. Well, it might be to an extent, but the markets are extremely strong, and the markets sometimes do push and push and push and force the Fed to do things they prefer not to do.
Absolutely, absolutely. And so one of the danger things we're watching for at the moment is, will the market force it on inflation? Will the market all of a sudden force the Fed to go, oh, okay, now we need to taper and maybe we'll start thinking about raising rates next year? And that, in my mind, would be a big policy mistake and could have some more lasting ramifications.
Mm. And of course, there are still a lot of economists and a lot of academics claiming that, you know, no, this is real inflation, you know, and they cite all of the, you know, lumber prices way through the roof, et cetera, right? But a lot of it's supply trend related.
Absolutely. And the other thing is, the other thing I want to say as well with all these commodity price concerns is that the commodities, to have commodity inflation, it has to keep going. Like, you can't just say, oh yeah, we had a 50% increase in lumber price or whatever, but now it needs to keep going up at whatever it is, 5-10% per year to keep that inflationary push going. And most of these are, like, let's say you look at the iron ore price or the copper price, like, these are at inflation adjusted, they're at highs they've never been at before. And these are things that actually have deflation over the longer term. So basically what you're saying is, in a way, for a lot of these commodities, people are saying, okay, although this commodity is deflationary over the long term and prices have been falling because technologically, you know, we're getting better and better, and now, you know, BHP and Rio's have got driverless trucks and driverless trains and all these things to just keep getting that cost down and down and down, is that that's going to be useless, and now the demand is going to be so strong and the supply is not going to react that inflation is sort of locked in for a long time. And that's where we have, I've certainly got big concerns over that. And I wrote something a few weeks ago just talking about the copper price in particular. There's a big push on that about saying electric vehicles use way more copper, and so therefore you must jump in. And I'm like, absolutely, electric vehicles do use sort of, I haven't got the numbers in front of me, but, you know, way more, hundreds of percent more copper than what normal cars do. But vehicles are actually a very small part of the overall copper market. Like, it's sort of around 10%. And if you had an extremely bullish view that basically, you know, from next year, we're going to start, you know, 50% of cars would be electric ones, and then building up to 100%, you know, over the next 10 years, that you're talking about a 1% increase in copper per annum demand. It's really just not such a big thing. It's what's more important is whether China keeps building houses at a rate we've never seen before. So because that uses it's way more relative. Copper than
it's all relative, yeah. Right? Yeah,
yeah. For every apartment that China decides not to build, you can go and make 3 or 4 electric vehicles. And so the number of apartments being built in China is basically one of the key things there.
Well, I want to sort of segue the conversation on, because this was from Jeff. Asked Damien what he thinks wages will rise. I see this as a massive risk if they don't give them the leverage and the debt. Now, 2 points to make. Inflation of input prices is one thing, materials.
Yep.
But the inflation we had in the 70s and the 80s was wages-based, right? It was massive, right? Yeah. There's no sign of that. No sign of that at all. In fact, even in the forward budget, there's no real wages growth in the economy, according to the Treasury, right?
Yep. And also to highlight as well that in the US, unemployment got down to 3.5% under Trump, and we still didn't see sign of wages growth. So wherever the level is that kicks in of unemployment, where we actually start seeing wages growth, it's a long, long way below where it is now.
Mm. And the argument is, I think, that there are actually different structural issues in play. Some of that's to do with insecure work, part-time work, gig economy jobs, those sorts of things. Technology has also making some things rather different. And going back to that share of, the relative share of income to the corporate sector versus to households, right? The two are falling in opposite directions, right? Income generation to the corporate sector is going through the roof. Income to the household sector is not. It's actually fading away. So there is a fundamental structural issue here. So my own view is, I think it's going to be very unlikely to see any wages growth for a long, long time. And, the Reserve Bank is saying, well, we need unemployment with a 3-point something in front of it. And as you say, even in the US, they had a 3-point something and they still didn't get wages growth.
Yeah, so on the wages side, and the other thing is, back in the 70s, a much larger share of the Australian economy and the US economy was involved in manufacturing, and now we're a lot more services. And so wages are more important to services. They're a much larger percent of the cost. So if you want to see inflation, you need to get wage inflation, even more so than the 70s and 80s. And so, that's the key one we're really watching. Is when do we actually really start to get wages inflation? I can't see any sign of it. And even on the inflation side as well, like we went through the G8 plus China in terms of looking at countries, just every country, and broke the breakdown of where's the inflation coming from over the recent months. And the bulk of it is coming from these sectors like used cars, like hotel rooms, like airline flights. And a lot of those are just, they're either base effects or they've fallen or they're still below prior levels. And, there are a lot of hotel rooms out there. They've got a lot of capacity. There are a lot of airline planes grounded. There is a lot of capacity with airlines. They're not certainly not areas we're expecting to see growth to continue at running at massive rates. And, if used cars kept on running at 10% per month, inflation, then pretty soon they'll be more expensive than new cars, where you've got 2% inflation. So it very much, inflation was in the transitory stuff as far as we could tell.
I think that's exactly right. Now here's another question. This is from The New Voice. You see the recent story in The Intercept about Wall Street cooking the books again, GFC style, but in the commercial market. SEC lawsuits against the rating agency now filed too. General observation, there seem to be a number of unfortunate behaviours beginning to appear again in various sections of the market. I heard overnight that the GFG Group, the Steel Group, they're going to have to sell off some of their assets in the UK because of questionable business operations and things. So there is still a lot of corporate misconduct around the place, and some of it quite institutionalised.
And we just went through this period of 12 months where bankruptcies were basically off the table. Bankruptcies are down, was it 20-30% over their prior years in one of the worst years ever. So there's definitely these are definitely out there. There's and we've seen a number of hedge funds sort of throughout when there's so much debt around. Invariably, people will get more loans than what they should have had. You saw the commodity trader that blew up. Mental blank on the name. We've seen the hedge fund recently sort of blow up in terms of this using too much debt. Yeah. Look, there is potentially a debt crisis out there. If you get enough of these things fall over at the same time. On the flip side, you do have central banks wanting to keep this market as liquid as possible, and it's quite possible as well that that when you read through the sort of long LTCM, which is long-term capital management, sort of had sort of these problems with using too much debt back in the late 90s. And at the time, basically the Fed got all the big players in the room and went, you guys all created this mess, you guys are fixing it. And, effectively forced some mergers on some of these, some of the financial companies. I wouldn't be surprised if there is a big blow-up, which there almost certainly will be, that's a similar type of pattern they'll take, is that they're going to try and make the financial companies merge or take the losses, some of the bigger ones take the losses, where needed to keep the whole system integrity together. They might get it wrong. There could be policy error, but I'm fully expecting that to be another feature of it.
And it's interesting because the disclosures from the UK relating to GFG and Greensill was that GFG had a bank, right? That bank was actually lending money to other interested parties, right? So it wasn't really doing arm's length lending like it was meant to. Now, the Bank of England knew about this about 3 or 4 years ago and did nothing about it. So once again, we seem to have the situation where some of our regulators and central banks are not actually necessarily taking the actions they should to deal with some of those unfortunate things that are going on. They prefer just to look the other way and hope it's going to work out.
And if that was 3 or 4 years ago, you can only imagine what's happened over the last 12 months, where they've been even more encouraged to not allow, to basically don't let companies go broke if you don't have to, extend the terms, all these different measures that were put in place to try and to try and stave off bankruptcies, and a lot of it was for good reason. Like, you didn't want a whole bunch of companies going broke for the sake of a 3-month shutdown that might have been able to bounce back. But then you start ending up with the thing about saying, okay, well, yes, you've done great for whatever it is, 50-60% of companies that really needed it, but there's going to be a bunch of people out there who were taking advantage of the whole situation, and they do need to be put into bankruptcy, and the sooner that can happen, the better. But same time, if it can be staged so that it doesn't bring the rest of the economy down, and then I think that's probably what they'll try and do.
And there's this talk about zombie companies, right? So companies that really, in the real world shouldn't be allowed to continue to trade, but they are still trading. So they're actually sucking capital out of the market, which could have gone to more productive areas, right? And people are trying to estimate what proportion of companies around the world are in zombie land. There's quite a big proportion.
Well, and part of it, if you just said, if we just had normal
sorry, there's a helicopter going over. Apologies for the noise.
That's right. If we'd had normal bankruptcy rates from last year, there would have been a bunch of companies gone broke, and so they're most likely to be zombie companies. And also, whether you call them zombies or not, but there's a bunch of companies out there who are basically surviving. They might not be going backwards, but they're basically surviving because interest rates are so low.
Yep.
If they had to pay a real rate of interest, then they wouldn't be surviving. And so, whether you want to call them zombies or not, that does, there are non-productive companies. Yeah. And that's where, often those are the companies that, and it's not just the capital, but it's the people as well, saying, well, if they've got hundreds of people employed at places that are really just trying to keep their head above water because debt rates are so low, then yes, it will be sad when those people lose their jobs. But if they're going to go to companies that are actually doing something rather than just trying to stay alive, then, that's probably a better thing for the economy overall.
And of course, the other trick is share buybacks, right, with rates so low. So some companies are doing that just to keep the share price going a little higher.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I'd, I've got mixed feelings on share buybacks. You know, on one hand, you look and go, well, when the best thing you can possibly think to do with your money is to go and buy your own shares, then, you know, is that saying something about the company? But the flip side is, especially internationally, is that it's a lot more tax effective for people to get their gains as a capital gain rather than as a dividend. And for a company, it's actually a lot easier. It does give them a bit more, companies with more volatile earnings, it gives them a bit more scope to say, well, if we're paying out, we're paying out 2% of earnings, but we think we could pay out 4%. We just don't want to commit to paying out 4% forever. A 4% yield, for example. So what we'll do is we'll pay a 2% dividend and we'll do the other 2% as a buyback. And so at least then shareholders are getting the money. And the last one I was going to say on that one was it also helps companies to gear up when they want to gear up. Now, that's a good thing and a bad thing. Overall, you say, yeah, I'd prefer if companies didn't have to have all this money. But if it's a choice between saying, here's a company that wants to have more debt because it thinks it's decided that the capital structure and the low interest rates, it actually wants to have more debt and less equity. If it couldn't do buybacks, basically what the company would do is it'd go and make an acquisition. And so, you know, let's say that it's a $100 million company with $20 million of debt, and it thinks it wants $50 million worth of debt. It can go and, in the old days, it would go out and make a $30 million debt-funded acquisition, and then it'd go, right, now we've got our capital structure right. And acquisitions don't tend to add a lot of value. And some of them are fantastic, but, a net across the entire market, they don't tend to add a lot of value, and they tend to make a lot of money for the brokers and not as much money for the investors. So if as a person who said, okay, rather than spending that $30 million buying something, I'll spend $30 million buying back my own shares, then I'm certainly happier with that as an outcome than going and sort of pissing money up against the wall, making an acquisition they didn't have to make. So, yes, so I get you. There's lots of negative things about it, but I also see, look, it could have been worse, I guess.
Exactly right. Now, here's a question for you from Vanessa. U.S. 10-year Trevor yields gone up, going down. Discuss.
I still think there's some more inflation scare coming. Having said that, you know, I'm sort of semi-hopeful we've reached the end of it, but I think it's probably, I think there's probably more inflation scares coming. I've basically taken the view now. So we a few months ago flipped back and changed a lot of our portfolio to really value stocks. And we got out of the long end of the bond curve and all into the short end of the bond curve with a view that these inflation numbers would come through, interest rates would go up, and everyone would be talking about, you know, inflation, here it comes. Have we reached peak inflation concern? I don't think so, but I think we're getting close. And so we're starting to move back the other way. We're not back to the stage of saying let's go for quality stocks and let's go to the long end of the curve, but I think over the next few months we will get to that point. It's not probably as direct answer as she wants, but I think there's probably a little bit more upward pressure before we've got some downward pressure as we start to see that the inflation is transitory, and I guess the But in keeping with this whole idea of uncertainty is that, you know, I'm not certain that's the outcome. And so this is where I think I'm going, and I've got my portfolio set up and we're gradually moving towards that as we get more certain that is what's going to happen. We'll just put more and more money to that end. And if it turns around and you don't get that inflation come through, or inflation does take off, or you get another, you know, you could see a more stimulus from the US Fed. You could see the Biden come out with another massive infrastructure package or another great deal for how he's going to, you know, pump more money into the economy or minimum wages up, things that we could see starting to cause inflation, and then we'll be changing strategy. So, you know, the default at the moment is, I think, up then down, but, you know, in keeping with the theme, it's an uncertain world, and we need to keep an eye on it.
Indeed. Jason, thank you very much for your contribution. Greatly appreciate it. Here's one for you. you're going to love this one. Rather than search for the one, says Tristan, why not use an ETF? And if so, which ones?
Yeah, absolutely. Look, I think there's certainly I have lots of sympathy for people who just go, look, I don't want to lean in. I'm just going to buy an ETF and forget about it. And if that's your way, I guess you'll never do better than average, but you won't do worse. And if you're happy with that as an outcome, then you know, I'd say that pick your ETFs, pick your strategy, put your money on autopilot, and then don't look at it. Come back in 20 years' time and see how you went. Because the problem with a lot of this is if you then start picking ETFs and then trying to time the market yourself in terms of saying, oh, well, I'll buy a bit more equities or a bit more bonds or things like that, then you've basically fallen into the thing of saying, well, you're going to do the asset allocation rather than giving it to a professional fund manager, you'll end up doing the same thing. We've recently started piloting a few funds which we're in our test mode at the moment. We'll be rolling it out sort of over the next few months, where what we're trying to do is index funds, so the same type of thing, but letting people actually knock things out. So if you don't want climate change, you can knock out climate change issues. If you don't want a property exposure in Australia, you can knock those out. So with the idea, rather than saying start build up your own portfolio, let's start with a big portfolio and then you can knock stuff out you don't like. So, but you know, if you're looking at ETFs, the key things I'd say for an ETF is you want to have an ETF which is low fees, and you want to have it in large liquid markets. There's some really fancy ETFs you can get. Some of them are what they call synthetic, so they don't actually own the underlying shares, and you can get caught out. There's other ones which are often what you call smart beta strategies or quite specific ones where they're in specific sectors. And sometimes those funds can really get caught holding different assets to what you think they might hold. So, you know, extreme example, I think, was one of those. There was a small cap fund in the US that ended up owning GameStop, like 20% GameStop. So, you know, you might have been buying an ETF thinking you weren't taking that much risk. And next thing you knew, you know, the hottest stock in the market at the time, at you know, thousands of dollars, you were buying into 20% of your fund was going into GameStop. And so, large liquid, broadly diversified funds is what I'd say within those. And if you like that area, watch this space, because you know, coming to the walk the world, you'll have you know, some relatively low cost funds as well, in terms of, and that are a bit more customizable and give you a few more tax benefits because you get to own the shares directly.
So here, a follow up question was from Tristan. What do you think of Vanguard products like VTI?
Vanguard. I can't remember exactly which one VTI is, but Vanguard generally has good products, and they are, I think it's not for profit, and so they tend to be one of the lowest cost ones out there. So yeah, Vanguard, you know, along with a few of the other big ones, BlackRock, the iShares guys, and then there's a third big player. There's three or four big players that have some very good funds out there.
Yeah,
pretty sure. Oh, sorry. I was just reading one of the questions on the market. Actually, I did see one. What was one of the ones saying before that there was a question up there, or a comment more saying that governments can't keep up the QE forever?
Yes.
That you flicked up, and that's true. They can't keep it up forever, but they can keep it up for a very long time.
Longer than we think they can, I think, probably, right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. And so, I mean, Japan's been at it for when did they start QE? Look, I'm guessing 15 years.
This must be close to 20, 25 now. It's a long time because they had the Asia crisis, right?
Yeah. So I mean, they've had problems. They've had the interest rates falling for interest rates sort of hit zero, I feel like 20 years ago, maybe more, in Japan. I'm not sure exactly how long after that they started QE. I don't think it was that much longer. But no. Yeah, a long, long time, though, is the answer. Yeah.
And look, it's worth just thinking about this for a second. The way QE works is basically one side issues, the other side buys. So you create assets and liabilities, right? Yep. So you start there and you basically go here, right? There's no limit if you have your own currency, there's no limit to how far you can push that.
No, that's right. And another way is that, you know, you're taking money out of one pocket and putting it into your other pocket. So, you know, in terms of the Japan does have, the Japanese government does have sort of, and the number, these numbers are just raw guesses at the rough level, but it's sort of 230%-ish debt to GDP. And but if you took out the central, how much the central bank owns, I think you get back to maybe 60%, 60 or 70%. So, yeah, it's it depends on how you want to measure it. And then so you can say, yes, the Japanese central bank owns 100, you know, owes 150% of GDP to another arm of the Japanese government. So it's like, well, so
it's sort of two pockets, right? You put it in one pocket, you take it out the other one, right? And you can go on doing that ad infinitum, right? Particularly when interest rates are low. The critical question, of course, is what happens if rates rise, right? And if you look at the forward budget for Australia, right, they're assuming that the price they will be able to pay for their debt does not go up over the forward estimates.
All right. Oh, okay. And over how long, how many years of that is it?
At least 5 years.
At least 5 years of no interest rate increases. Well, I guess the central bank said none for 3 years, so yes. I guess Treasury's...
The problem there is that they might be a little bit flexible with the truth when it comes to...
budget forecaster, yeah, that's right.
Budget forecast. How accurate have they been? Yeah.
But I guess the one of the things to keep in mind as well with interest rates is that because there's so much debt, not as much in the Australian government, there's actually not that much, but because there's so much debt in the in corporates and in consumers, if you raise rates too far, you very quickly start causing recessions. And so, you know, I guess the people who are like saying, yes, if interest rates go back to 5%, then there's going to be all these problems, is like, well, yeah, forget about the problems, those problems you're talking about, you know, when it goes back to 5%, because the first problem you've got is the massive, you know, recession or depression you've just caused by raising interest rates that far, when you know, debt to GDP is so large, both within consumers and with corporates, because you've just sent a whole bunch of people broke and a bunch of companies as well. So, you know, I think there's a stage where there's so much debt out there that we can't raise interest rates back to old levels, but until you actually get enough inflation that sort of inflates that away.
Well, the fundamental strategy, I think, that the Reserve Bank and other central banks want is they want to inflate the debt away ultimately, because that's the only way that they can actually ever deal with this. That, you know, if you take the long route of trying to pay it off with very low inflation rates, it's almost impossible. So in a way, they on one hand want inflation because that will deflate the debt. But then on the other hand, if inflation starts to rise, interest rates go up, and that's going to mess everybody. So they're really caught, in my mind, between these two polar opposites, neither of which is actually very, very palatable.
Mm. No, that's right. But it's a lot more palatable to, you know, inflation sort of takes a little bit from everyone, and it's pretty painless in terms of, if you raise taxes to get there, you get a lot of squealing. But if you just steal the money from people effectively by financial repression and not giving them as good a return on their money, then people don't notice as much.
Financial repression is a very good word. Or in other words, what is happening is that house prices are not going up in value. It's just that the value of your dollar is going down, and so you need more of those dollars to buy the same house as previously. Right?
Yeah, that's right.
Turn it on its head and think about it like that, right?
It is pretty
interesting. And look, there is no doubt in my mind that they will be able to do more quantitative easing, a lot more of it than many people think, right? Particularly now when they've actually got everybody saying debt's not a problem, the real target is really, really low unemployment, right? So that has really twisted the argument compared with where they were even 2 or 3 months ago. You know, I can remember when the Treasurer was previously talking about we have to start getting the debt under control. No. The debt is not now even being thought about, being worried about.
Yeah, and the part that central banks, if they're out there trying to buy money and they're out there trying to buy more debt and the government's not issuing it, then that's where they start. They've reached the limit. They've already hit the zero interest rate. The stuff they're doing in terms of quantitative easing is really just trying to convince the central bank. Sorry, they're really just trying to influence the government to actually go and spend the money. I spoke about the German rates. So the 10-year rate in Germany for the government is still negative. So, 5 years ago, or sorry, not 5 years ago, pre-crisis, it was pre the financial crisis. So back in the 2005, the German bond rate was 5%. So basically, the government was saying, to the German government, you go out and lend money, you go and spend money on building the nation and positive infrastructure projects and all that, and we'll charge you 5%. And then a few years later, it was down to 2.5%. They're basically saying, look, we'll give it to you for half the price we're willing to do it if you just get out and spend the money. And then it hit zero. It was basically saying, look, please take this money and go out and spend it. We'll give it to you for free if you'll just get out and spend it. And now we're at the stage where they're saying, we will pay you if you will just go take our money and go out and build something with it or put it back into the economy to actually grow the economy. And they're still not out there spending. Not in any meaningful way. And so, if you think about, bond yields in that sense, really what central banks are trying to do is get the yields low enough that governments will actually say, well, if I can borrow at 1% or 1.5% and inflation is going to be 2 or 3%, then all I need to do is find something that's not going backwards by more than, if I can find something that's giving me a 0% real return, then it should be worth investing in or worth spending the money on. And so we're starting to get there for governments. We're still not really in that phase where it's still reluctant in terms of the spending.
I've done a number of pieces of work for commercial clients over the years, building business cases, right? And they still have the same sort of target return rate as they did 10 years ago, despite the fact the rates are way lower, right?
Yes.
It's one of the reasons why a lot of investment isn't happening.
And so what return would you use on that?
Quite often they'd be looking at 10 to 12%.
Yeah. And the reason for that from a commercial perspective is these things are uncertain. You do your best on it, but you're making very uncertain decisions for business cases. And so you do need quite a broad range. And so, you might say you're looking at 12%, which was 6% of that was the interest rate, and 6% was some sort of risk-free rate. And now you're looking and going, well, the interest rate isn't there, but the risk is actually higher than what it was. And so you sort of add a bit more and take a bit more off. And you also say, well, do I really want to take all this risk and just get a 6% return?
Yeah, and that's the point, right? So, if you look at where the investment isn't happening, right? The commercial sector is not investing very much in Australia at the moment, right? Mm. Other than construction, surprise, right? Which is of course one reason why they're pushing the construction sector and particularly the, the housing sector. Some of the infrastructure spending that they're talking about making isn't going to happen immediately. It's going to take quite a few years to flow through. So. Yep.
All the solar stuff and the renewable stuff, we don't have the certainty relative to other countries. A lot of who've sort of said this is the path, we just don't have that same certainty here.
So it begs the question then, where is that investment-led recovery going to come from? The answer is, I don't see it, right? Which it goes back to then, that means we're going to have to do more QE and more government debt because basically the rest of the economy is just not firing.
And we need to get the currency down as well. The stage where it makes more sense to invest in Australia as a if you're somebody sitting in say the US and you're looking at your Asia Pacific operations and saying I want to add a new lawyer or a new accountant somewhere in the Asia Pacific time zone, you're looking at Australia, Singapore, Japan, possibly Hong Kong, working out where's it best and most cost effective to put somebody. Australia is not a no brainer for that's where you're going to add it, and if you get to that stage where it is, that's where you can see more investment coming into Australia, and all these manufacturing that's shut down in Australia because of the high dollar back in the 2008, 2007, 2008, when the mining boom was going to go forever. And so we had a high Australian dollar. They're the ones that would really benefit as the Aussie dollar falls. But the Aussie dollar is going to have to fall further because they've left the country before they actually decide to come back to the country.
Well, we're in the last 5 minutes now, but here's one just to give you a consideration too. This is from Cookie Boy. Does Damon believe the ABS stats are true or something else?
Let's put it this way. I don't think there's a conspiracy amongst the staff working at the ABS to make the numbers look better than what the government thinks they should look. So, do I think inflation is? I'm guessing it comes back to the question: is do I think inflation is higher than what the ABS is saying? And the stuff I've looked at is very much that. It's very difficult in that inflation in regular everyday items seems to be higher than intermittent items. And so it's a question about going, well, if you want to replace your car and the price of cars is actually coming down over time, you might be able to replace it after 2.5 years rather than 3 years, or after 4 years rather than 7 years, or whatever, you know, whatever time frame you're looking at, there's a slight benefit to it. But you actually had a bit of a choice often where you could – so if the prices were going up, you might delay it another year before you actually bought one. Whereas when the price of your healthcare goes up, or the price of your schooling goes up, or the price of your everyday items goes up, then you just got to cop it. You've just got to pay for those things. And I think that's where I think that's the part that for people on a lived experience is where you see that inflation coming through. A lot higher than what you'll see from the ABS. And so, I think it's they're reporting what they think is an average person and probably is right, but I think it's the problem of, I don't know what the right way to say it is. It's I guess, one where you can shift the time. I think that there's lots of deflation in that area.
And it's interesting because my surveys, and I run the surveys all the time, as you know, highlight that the cost of living are absolutely catching people, right? And it's the everyday things, right? It's the when you go down to Coles, you know, or Woolies or whatever it is, and you buy, you know, you buy your groceries, or healthcare costs. I mean, the day-to-day costs of living, they seem to be accelerating away much faster than the official statistics represent, right?
Yes, and the whole I used to be able to buy lunch for $5 or $6 and it was fine, and then it was $10, and now it's closing in on $12 or $13, and it's those types of bits about that people see every day.
Yeah, and in a way, that's the problem. So, the real lived experience of people and what the official story is broken. It's the same with employment as well. So the official statistics is based on a certain definition of employment, which means working for more than 1 hour a week, you're not unemployed, yep. Right? But then if you look at the true unemployment figures and the underemployment numbers, they're a lot higher. Now, interestingly, the definition of how CPI is calculated and the definition of how unemployment is calculated is based on a series of globally agreed standards. In other words, all of the statistical bodies around particularly the Western world and the central banks around the Western world are all dancing the same tune because, of course, the Reserve Bank argued it about 20-odd years ago to take the cost of housing out of the CPI. So
yes,
it's worth understanding that none of these numbers are absolutely correct, right? There's a bunch of assumptions. There's a bunch of things that have gone on there. And sometimes my own view is they don't signal the right truth. They signal a convenient truth.
Yeah, and so I mean, I spoke about saying, look, we went through all the G7 countries and looking at all the individual ones, and everyone reports a bit differently, but really what we were trying to work out there is if we started with December numbers, we said basically if you measured from December 15 months ago, and with the idea of going, let's get rid of those base effects, so that we want to make sure we're not seeing the base effects, and then we really want to see where are the categories coming through. And we saw enough things coming through where you'd go, you know, fruit prices were all up generally around the world, but actually vegetable prices were down. And so you sort of look at things like that and try and work out, well, is there inflation here which looks like it's pervasive and much higher levels than it's been in the past, and it's going to start pushing that whole, you get that whole cost push inflation where, you know, prices are high and therefore the next ones. But, you know, very much all the stuff we were looking at was saying, you know, the steady, stable, they call them the sticky prices, like your healthcare and those swings. You've got inflation in them, but it wasn't runaway inflation by any means.
Yeah,
I should have. That's a chart. Actually, I've got a chart on that one, which I think as well. That's actually one following up on that thought. Mm. The last few years, and this is a US one. So I'm just thinking of the US data that I've seen. You had like 4 or 5 years of inflation running at sort of 2.5 to 3% in the US on what they call sticky items, things like, you know, healthcare, education, housing, those types of things. Whereas you had deflation in those things like your high volatility items, like your food and your energy and things like that. And then that's flipped around in the last month, so that you're sort of running still about 2.4%, I think, was the most recent one. But the non-sticky ones are running at like 10% inflation rates.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, the point about on any of these measuring methods, right, is they always contain bunches of assumptions, bunches of averages, and individuals aren't average. Right, and that's the problem, right? So individual experiences are often disconnected from those sort of high-level numbers.
Absolutely. And that's the economist, the old economist joke. You know, you get your head in the fire and your feet in the freezer, and on average, you're the right temperature. So,
yeah, exactly right. Here's one just to finish up with. Thanks for the stream. Always interesting. Must say, not sure where to invest. Uncertainty does seem to rule.
It does. Look, I mean, I'll tell you what we're investing in at the moment. I don't know, you know, without saying this is what you have to do, but I'll tell you what our thoughts are is for the last few months, it's all been about saying we think there's an inflation scare coming, and so we want to make sure that we're not underperforming while the inflation scare is coming. And so what that meant was buying resources, buying banks, buying energy stocks, and buying lots of value stocks, so lots of stocks that are cheap and leveraged to economic up cycles. That's been a great thing for the last 4 or 5 months. Oh no, probably longer, maybe 6 months. I think there's probably a month or two still to go in it, but I'm starting to unwind out of that trade now because I do think it's going to go the other way. If you think inflation's here to stay, and I could be wrong, and you know, I'm certainly looking every day for evidence that I might be wrong, then I'll flip back. I'll stick with that trade, or I'll go more of it. But at the moment, what we're doing is going the other way, and we're trying to pick up exposure to more growth, more quality type stocks, and more international as well. With the view that look, the Australian dollar's pretty close to the top, we think, and over the next few years, it does appear that, you know, that downward is more likely than upward.
Very good. And I had just a couple of other quick questions. Somebody asked, in fact, AI asked, do you use any AI in your analysis? Artificial intelligence.
Yeah, look, a little bit. I think I spent a long time at Schroeder's. This was sort of like one of the main things I was doing was text analysis. Different ways of analyzing things. I think what I find very much is that AI is good for analyzing things like text, where there's an answer that's relatively certain, I guess, in terms of the meaning. That's, I mean, even within text, it's not that certain as to what people mean sometimes. When it comes to actually using AI to try and pick stocks, what you tend to find is that AI is very good at finding what you should have done, you know, 5 years ago, and not as good at doing what you should be doing for the next 5 years. Mm. It tends to overfit every time, and there's a lot of variables going into this that you just don't see, or might not have been an issue. So, you know, regulatory factors or central bank puts and all these things like that. You know, yes, you can keep adding them into your models, but you can be pretty sure certain that whatever caused the last big spike up or the big spike down in prices isn't going to be the same issue that's going to cause the next one. It's going to be something completely different. So, yeah. Yeah.
So they're often quite good looking backwards, predicting forwards. I used a lot of AI with my segmentation, right? And they're very useful, confirming what I saw. Pretty awful at trying to predict the future. Crystal ball probably works a little better.
Yeah. And so, I mean, what I like to do is I like to use a lot of models, a lot of quant models to tell me what the quant model thinks should happen. And then I use my judgment as to what, you know, whether it's right or not, especially in terms of saying the quantitative models, what the problem with a lot of AI is you don't know why. The quantitative model likes them. Like, you can have these AIs that have gone, I've analyzed all these statistics, and the next thing it's saying, go out and do this thing, but it can't tell you exactly why. Whereas if I can get down to, okay, the quant models that I run tend to throw out, okay, I want to buy this stock because I like these types of stocks tend to go up when inflation rises, and so therefore it likes this set of stocks. Those types of things I can then deal with and say, okay, you like those stocks, but I actually disagree with the fundamental reason for that happening, or I think that something else is going to be playing a bigger part. So it might be that you buy stocks that are you buy these types of stocks and it's a sector where you saw lots of takeover activity or something like that, and so it's saying buy those stocks because you tend to make a takeover return on it. So going, okay, well, that's fine, but I need to now look at the stocks and say, are the takeovers going to keep happening? Do I need to, is that what I apply to it? And so, AI, you need to be running the types of models where you can actually see why it wants to, what it likes about it, and a lot of AI doesn't.
Indeed. Well, look, I think we've overrun our time. Thank you very much for your time tonight, Damon. Very interesting. And I think, the bottom line takeout is this, that whilst there's a lot of uncertainty out there in the real world and in the financial markets, there are still things that people can do sensibly. And as we've tried to highlight, there are some principles in terms of thinking in the right time frame, thinking about the right types of investments that still makes sense to invest. So we don't have to sit on the sidelines and just say, well, until everything crashes, we don't do anything, right? Because your point from right up the top of the show was you miss out, or the risk is you miss out because things take quite a long time to perhaps to work through, and with all the government stimulus and everything else, we may not actually collapse immediately, and therefore you've got to build your investment strategy based on the more steady state view of the world rather than the crisis collapsing world.
And the internet, and I don't, not that I want to denigrate YouTube channels, because we have our own YouTube channel and you're obviously have a very good one here, but if you want to spend enough time on YouTube channels, you can definitely find a lot of people who are going to tell you the world's going to end, and so it's a it's a question about big question is when, and so for the moment there's lots of uncertainty about it, but the problems seem a little bit further away than they certainly did this time last year.
Excellent. Well, thank you for your time. And just to say to everybody that the Walk the World Fund is powered by Nucleus Wealth. Go to walktheworld.com.au if you want more information, both investing inside super and also investing outside super. And, recent returns have been pretty good, very transparent, and actually the fees are pretty good too. So, bit of a recommendation there if you want to go find more out about that. That's the way to do it. We'll catch up again next month, and maybe we'll spend a bit more time talking in more detail about quants and that analysis stuff, because there's quite a lot of interest on the chat there, as we came to that quite late in the show. So thank you very much.
Sure. And I'll hit you up on inflation part of the way through the month as well. We've got a piece coming out.
Great. Week. Well, let's book a sort of a pre-record on that when it's coming out, and we'll make sure that it's put up on our channel too, because that's a really, really live conversation and very, very, very important. So great.
Excellent. Thanks a lot, Martin.
Thank you very much. Have a good evening, and I'm just going to take you offline, then I'll close the show. Thanks. See you, Damon. Bye. Oh, there you go. We're way over time once again. Sorry, it's just so much going on. So I appreciate everybody hanging around. Just to say that next week, you've got me, no guests, just me talking about household stress and scenarios, updating the models, and also talking specifically about some of the latest research that I've been doing. So join me then next week, 1st of June. Latest information from the mortgage stress modelling. Given the current information that I'm seeing at the moment, it'll be a very important show. There's a lot of significant pressures coming through. And I did made a show earlier today just to highlight the fact that there are lots of households who are definitely in some difficulty. So thank you very much for watching the show tonight. Thanks for staying with us to the end. Thanks for all the contributions from those who made them. Please, if you haven't liked the show, do like the show. It really does help to spread the gospel. And we will see you this time next week. This is Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics signing off. Cheerio.